From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Now, we're projecting that more than 2.2 million families will lose their home in this subprime foreclosure crisis. These are families who have been shuffled from adjustable rate mortgage to adjustable rate mortgage over the last several years, but with housing prices turning, are finding that that option is no longer available.
Subprime loans. Customers with low credit ratings get mortgages with very high interest rates. Is it predatory lending? Millions of families around the country face losing their homes to foreclosure. Then, In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. We'll look at a new documentary with Danny Schechter, the news dissector. An independent journalist, Josh Wolf, is released from prison after spending over 225 days behind bars.
The real issue is the investigative role of a journalist, in both as a journalist for the public and then being demanded by the courts. And I was able to prevent that from happening.
Josh Wolf spent more time in jail than any journalist in U.S. history for protecting his sources. He'll join us from San Francisco. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. ABC News is reporting the U.S. is engaged in a secret war with Iran. Since 2005, U.S. officials have been advising a Pakistani tribal militant group with ties to the Taliban on how to carry out deadly guerrilla raids inside Iran. The Pakistani group, called Jundala, has taken responsibility for the deaths and kidnappings of more than a dozen Iranian soldiers and officials. Most recently, Jundala took credit for a bus bombing that killed at least 11 members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in February. Officials say the U.S. relationship with Jundala is arranged so that the U.S. provides no funding to the group, which would require an official presidential order or finding, as well as congressional oversight. Some former CIA officers say the arrangement is reminiscent of how the U.S. government used proxy armies to destabilize the government of Nicaragua in the 1980s. In other news on Iran, the British government has announced it's willing to send a delegation to Tehran to help ease the crisis over the 15 detained British sailors. Iran's first vice president, Parviz Davoodi, said Britain should admit its forces had illegally entered Iranian waters and guarantee they would not do so again. Iran's capture of the British sailors and Marines came 2 months after the U.S. seized five Iranian officials in Iraq. On Tuesday, President Bush said the United States would not be willing to give up the five Iranians held in Iran in exchange for the British sailors.
First of all, the seizure of the sailors is indefensible by the Iranians. And that I support the Blair government's attempts to solve this issue peacefully. So we're in close consultation with the British government. I also strongly support the Prime Minister's declaration that there should be no quid pro quos when it comes to the hostages.
The U.S. has been holding the five Iranians in an undisclosed location since January 11th. The Iraqi government has urged the Bush administration to release the five Iranians, but the U.S. has ignored the requests. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has arrived in Damascus and is meeting today with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. She has been urging Syria to help stabilize Iraq and stop supporting Washington's adversaries in the Middle East. Pelosi is the highest-ranking U.S. politician to travel to Syria in years. On Tuesday, President Bush condemned Pelosi's trip.
Photo opportunities and or meetings with President Assad lead the Assad government to believe they're part of the mainstream of the international community, when in fact they're a state sponsor of terror.
Pelosi is traveling as part of a bipartisan congressional delegation. In Iraq, the Washington Post is reporting nearly 2,800 Iraqi civilians and police officers died last month, despite the new U.S. security offensive in Baghdad. Earlier today, gunmen killed 11 employees of an electricity station in an ambush near the Iraqi city in the north of Kirkuk. In Washington, tensions rising between the White House and Congress over the funding of war in Iraq. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid backed Senator Russ Feingold's plan to cut off funding by next year and to withdraw combat troops within 12 months. This is Senator Harry Reid.
I do not believe there should be a single drop of American blood, additional blood, shed in Iraq. I do not believe there should be another head injury in Iraq of an American soldier. Let the Iraqis handle their own country. We've spent billions of dollars training their troops. We've spent billions of dollars propping up their government. As far as I'm concerned, that's enough.
Meanwhile, President Bush accused Democrats of being irresponsible for leaving town without sending him a bill to fund the war in Iraq.
Democrat leaders in Congress seem more interested in fighting political battles in Washington than providing our troops what they need to fight the battles in Iraq. Democrat leaders in Congress are bent on making a political statement. Then they need to send me this unacceptable bill as quickly as possible when they come back. I'll veto it. And then Congress can get down to the business of funding our troops without strings and without delay.
Independent journalist Josh Wolf has been released from prison after spending over 225 days behind bars. The 24-year-old videographer spent more time in jail than any journalist in U.S. history for protecting his sources. He was jailed on August 1st of last year when he refused to turn over video to a federal grand jury that he had shot of a protest in San Francisco. As part of a deal with prosecutors, Wolf decided to publicly release the video. In return, prosecutors agreed not to summon him before the grand jury or ask him to identify any of the protesters shown on his videotape. Josh Wolf spoke yesterday at a news conference in San Francisco.
Were I to testify, they'd go through the video and go, do you know that person? Do you know that person? As new people showed up on the film. Anyone that I said I knew, they'd probably ask me, how can I contact them? Then those people would be called in, forced to watch the tape, and identify everyone they knew. I'm assuming everyone would also be asked incidental questions, but to me it seemed like a witch hunt akin to McCarthyism, where in this case it was anarchists before it was communists.
Josh Wolf will join us from San Francisco later in the broadcast. The Washington Post is reporting a secret FBI intelligence unit helped detain a group of war protesters in a downtown Washington parking garage in April 2002 and interrogated some of them on videotape about their political and religious beliefs. For years, law enforcement authorities suggested the incident never happened, but recently unearthed D.C. police logs confirmed the FBI's role. According to the police records, the protesters were targeted largely because they were wearing the color black and perceived by police to be anarchists. After the protesters were detained, FBI agents dressed in street clothes separated members to question them one by one about protests they attended, whom they had spent time with recently, what political views they espoused, and the significance of their tattoos and slogans. According to the Washington Post, the revelations provide the first public evidence that Washington, D.C.-based FBI personnel use their intelligence-gathering powers in the district to collect purely political intelligence. The police records came to light because of a lawsuit filed on behalf of the protesters by the Partnership for Civil Justice. In news from Africa, the Associated Press reports CIA and FBI agents have been interrogating hundreds of detainees held at secret prisons in Ethiopia. The detainees include at least one U.S. citizen. Many of the prisoners have been transferred secretly and illegally in recent months from Kenya and Somalia to Ethiopia, where they're kept without charge or access to lawyers and families. Human Rights Watch has accused the U.S. of being the ringleader behind the secret prisons. The group described the prisons as a, quote, decentralized, outsourced Guantanamo. At least one American citizen is being held in Ethiopia. 24-year-old Amr Mohammed Mashal was detained in Kenya, then transferred to Somalia, then to Ethiopia. On Monday, U.S. Congressmember Rush Holt of New Jersey called on Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to demand his release. His parents live in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. In news on Somalia, the United Nations is reporting 100,000 residents of Mogadishu have now fled the city since February because of the increasing violence. The UN Refugee Agency said the exodus is comparable to conditions after the ouster of Mohamed Siad Barre in 1991. This is Millicent Mutale of the United Nations.
In the last 2 weeks, there are estimates of up to 50,000 people who have left Mogadishu, and many people are saying that their lives are at risk. There's indiscriminate shooting. There is robbing of people at their homes, people on the road. Basically, there's a breakdown of law and order, and people are leaving.
There are new developments in the scandal over the Bush administration's firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. One of the dismissed prosecutors has revealed he was pressured by Republican officials to target the advocacy group ACORN for voter fraud. ACORN was working on a voter registration drive in low-income and largely minority neighborhoods in New Mexico. Iglesias told Newsweek he found no case worth bringing against ACORN, but that apparently did not please the White House. Last week, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, ex-chief of staff Decal Sampson, testified that during the run-up to the midterm election, White House advisor Karl Rove complained that David Iglesias and two other U.S. attorneys had not done enough to prosecute so-called voter fraud. A new international poll by the BBC has found more than two-thirds of the world's people are worried by global warming. Americans were found to be among the least anxious about climate change, even though the United States is the top source of greenhouse gases. The poll found 57% of Americans are concerned over global warming. The BBC found Brazilians and South Africans are the most concerned. In China, developers have demolished a home that was at the center of a standoff between developers who wanted to build a new shopping mall and a couple who wanted to keep living in their home. For the past 3 years, Wu Ping and Yang Wu refused to move out of the home to make room for the mall. They stayed in the house even after developers demolished 280 neighboring houses. Their house ended up standing isolated on an earthen mound in the middle of a huge 30-foot-deep construction site. The couple became champions of housing rights advocates in China and around the world. Last week, a Chinese court ordered them to leave or face forcible removal. The couple agreed to leave the home on Monday, and within 3 hours, the building was demolished. In California, a federal judge has backed a Marine's effort to be discharged from the military as a conscientious objector. Last year, 23-year-old Lance Corporal Robert Zabala of San Jose filed for objector status, saying he was particularly appalled by the Marines' attempts to desensitize new recruits to violence. The Marines originally turned down his application for conscientious objector status. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Subprime loans have led to 1 million American families losing their homes in the past decade. This, according to a new study by the Center for Responsible Lending. In the last 10 years, the subprime loan industry has emerged as a major and controversial player in the housing market. Under a subprime loan, customers with low credit ratings are offered mortgages in return for high interest rates. Proponents have advocated subprime financing as a way for low-income residents to own their first home. But new figures suggest the subprime industry is having the opposite effect. The Center for Responsible Lending estimates that between 1998 and 2006, about 1.4 million first-time homebuyers purchased their homes using subprime loans, but the study also finds that the number of projected subprime foreclosures in that same period was a whopping 2.4 million. This means subprime lending resulted in a net loss of home ownership for almost 1 million families. Here in New York, the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project put out a report showing foreclosures rose 50% last year, with more than 9,000 homeowners facing the loss of their homes. And in this year, foreclosures are on track to hit 15,000. We now go to Durham, North Carolina, where we're joined by Senior Policy Counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending, Keith Ernst. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, in the last few months, we've seen many news articles basically about the lending companies and the financial crisis among some of these subprime lenders. And we've seen some coverage of the impact on homeowners around the country. But could you put this crisis in context from your perspective, what is happening around the country?
Of course. For years, the subprime market has been this just burgeoning industry. And lenders have been making loans to millions of families. And for a while, it looked like things would go on smoothly. But as housing prices softened and weakened, what we saw was the weakness in these mortgages they were making exposed to the light of day. And essentially now, the sad ramifications of this is an uptick in foreclosures, sometimes in places that haven't really seen a spike in foreclosures in years, places like New York and California and Northern Virginia, where, for all intents and purposes, we've been in a boom for the first half of this decade.
And in terms of the, your group issued a report at the end of last year projecting what the potential impact would be over the next few years in terms of foreclosures. Could you talk about that?
Sure, that's right. So we projected that more than 2.2 million, so now 2.4 million families will lose their homes ultimately to foreclosure as these mortgages come to a halt, or at least as these mortgages play out. And that's deeply concerning. These are families who, in many instances, this house is their primary asset. It's how they're holding their wealth. It's their nest egg for retirement. And those homes are at just tremendous jeopardy right now. And largely, this is because of the shoddy underwriting that's taken place in the subprime market in recent years, and these so-called mortgage resets, where a borrower's interest rate could go from 8% to as high as 12% just 2 years into their mortgage. And this, you know, this results in a payment increase of 30 to 40% on their mortgage. Families who are just sort of struggling to get by day to day are faced with this just insurmountable hurdle 2 years into the mortgage. And, you know, what they're finding now is that, you know, foreclosure may be the only option for them.
Keith Ernst, can you explain the difference between a prime and a subprime loan?
Of course. You know, for years, borrowers in this country could only get a mortgage if they met fairly narrow underwriting criteria. You know, they had to put 20% down in their home, they had to have stable incomes, and, you know, they had to have a relatively blemish-free credit record. Over the last 10 or so years, what's happened in this nation is that lenders have gotten more flexible in who they're willing to lend to. And in principle, this is a good thing because it means that families who need to tap into their wealth, whether it's to send a child to college, to pay for a medical procedure, or, you know, for other purposes, can do that. And that in principle is a good thing. But what's happened in the subprime market is that lenders have gotten overly aggressive, made loans that borrowers simply can't afford, and that's sort of the story today.
Could you talk about the role of major banks in this whole process? I did a story in the New York Daily News last week about the role of Credit Suisse, First Boston, in repackaging these loans in the securities industry. And they actually had a whole division called their NINA department, No Income, No Asset Loans, right, that they were repackaging.
Right. One of the interesting stories here underneath all this is how these mortgages came about in the first place. You know, we like to think, or I think most Americans think, that mortgages are made by banks and depository institutions. But especially in the subprime market, that's not the case. They're largely made through state-chartered finance companies that don't have any bank deposits, and so they don't have any bank regulators. Where do they go for their money? They go to Wall Street. So Wall Street will supply them the money to make the loans, will buy the loans from these lenders, and then will repackage them into securities and sell them to investors. Now again, in principle, that's fine. It can make low-cost capital available to families who need mortgages. The problem comes when the insatiable appetite builds for more and more mortgages, and lenders get reckless with regard to the quality of the mortgages they're originating.
What kind, Keith Ernst, what kind of regulation, federal regulation, is there of this, and also local regulation?
Right. You know, Amy, the regulators are really, they're just scrambling to catch up now. What we've seen is the federal regulators just this spring have come out with proposed subprime lending guidance that would require lenders to ensure that borrowers can afford their mortgage when those payments jump up. So not at the initial introductory rate, which is only going to be in effect for 2 short years, but at the fully indexed the rate that's going to apply after that introductory period is over. And we think that's a tremendous step forward. But it's coming too late for many families. Many families are finding that their mortgages are resetting and are in trouble now. You know, that's at the federal level. We've got that regulatory action. Congress is looking into bills to protect borrowers from these sorts of practices and also from other sorts of predatory lending practices, like putting borrowers in loans with abusive back-end prepayment penalties that can cost thousands of dollars if they try to refinance, you know, the month before these payments reset while they can still, while they're still current and can afford their mortgage, and other similar abuses. And in the states, they're starting to take a look and ask, how can we really help protect the borrowers in our backyard?
Juan, you've been doing a series of pieces in the New York Daily News, and you've been profiling families. Tell us about some of them.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask Keith Ernst about that. For instance, there was one woman that I profiled, Sandra Barkley, who's part of a whole lawsuit now against a big developer in Brooklyn. Here was a woman who was working for the New York City Housing Authority, was barely making about $24,000 a year, and these predatory lenders and got her into a home where her mortgage payments, monthly mortgage payments, were higher than her total gross income. There was a lawyer that they supplied to her who sat at the closing for this home and actually told her to sign these papers. And because what I'm finding is that the appraisers, to some degree, are involved in over-appraising these houses. There are crooked lawyers that are in cahoots with some of these lenders that are allowing their, quote, clients to sign these mortgages that they could not possibly pay. And you were mentioning the interest rates. Well, I have a story in today's Daily News about an elderly couple who was basically forced out of their home. They weren't even in the market for a home and put into two mortgages totaling about $600,000. One of them, the interest rate can go up to 18% on one of the mortgages, and the other is an interest-only mortgage. They are guaranteed not to be able to pay the $4,000 payment that they had when before they were paying $1,200 a month. So where are the regulators in this situation where these lawyers, the appraisers, and the brokers are being able to manipulate and bamboozle folks into these kinds of loans?
Right. Well, first, let me just say that, you know, those family stories you're recounting are not at all unusual. And it goes back largely to what are the incentives in place to originate these mortgages. If we think, you know, I think we should recognize that there are powerful incentives that brokers and loan originators make thousands of dollars in each mortgage, and in fact make more on larger mortgages. And so there's incredible incentives to provide borrowers with the largest mortgage they're willing to take out. Now, as that demand has grown in recent years, we've seen skyrocketing rates of mortgages with less than full income documentation. Some are these so-called liar loans where the income is just put down in the application. Many times borrowers have told us when we showed them their paperwork that they had no idea that income was reported. Now their signature was on the bottom of the paper, but that signature was put on there at the blizzard of closing where they were told to initial here, sign there about 1,500 times. And so, you know, what's happened is these mortgages, there are tremendous incentives to originate them. Borrowers are looking to the person opposite the table from them as an expert who can help provide them with some guidance, and the person on the other side of the table just doesn't have their best interest at heart. Now, where have the regulators been through all this is a good question. I think the federal regulators are scrambling to catch up now. State regulators are likewise following suit, and Congress is taking a look. You know, unfortunately, I think the reality is that it often takes a crisis like this to provoke us to take action to protect people.
Keith, we have to break, but we're going to come back to this discussion. Keith Ernst is an attorney, senior policy counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending, speaking to us from Durham, North Carolina. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by Danny Schechter, the News Dissector. His latest documentary that's opening tonight in New York is called In Debt We Trust. Stay with us.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. Borrowing and debt. In Debt We Trust.
It's kind of hard to serve the master and MasterCard.
Just need your signature right here, please.
The gospel of shopping. The gospel of buying things.
Our society has been really set up to keep us struggling and not give us relief.
In Debt We Trust.
The national savings rate is now zero.
It's just making my family even more poor.
Now let's see just how shopping can be fun. Real fun.
To shop till we drop.
Yeah, you get free money, but you have to pay.
We just constantly are getting bombarded from the credit card companies.
Stop sending me credit card letters, man. I don't want any more credit cards. I already have bad credit.
And it's like, don't send it. I don't want it.
Debt is profitable.
I received a credit card for a limit of $10,000.
Debt is profitable.
At that time, I was not making any kind of money.
Debt is profitable.
In debt, we trust.
I can tell you at Citibank and at other companies I've been in, many senior executives are extremely cynical.
Your choice, your Chase.
In debt we trust, Polarity One, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking to Keith Ernst, a senior policy counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending in Durham, North Carolina. We're also joined in studio by filmmaker and journalist Danny Schechter, who has a new film called In Debt We Trust. Your response to the subprime lending and this unprecedented number of foreclosures in the country.
You know, Amy, when we talk about this, I think of a phrase we used to use back at ABC when I worked there. It's called MIGO, and that refers to my eyes glaze over. Whenever people hear about economic issues, they sort of tune out because it sounds very complicated. What this reduces itself to is a crime. We're talking about a crime, CSI, crime scene, and we're part of this crime scene. We're talking about a cesspool of corruption implicating some of the biggest banks and financial institutions in the country, inattention by the regulators. 52% of the agencies making these loans are not even regulatable because they're not federally regulated organizations. We're talking about millions of Americans who can't make their bills, who are squeezed beyond belief. And this is not just an issue for regulators. This is an issue for progressives to respond to. We need a movement here to try to take up these issues of economic justice in America because we're not paying attention to it. And this cuts across racial lines, it cuts across ethnic lines, it cuts across political lines. We've set up Americans for Debt Relief Now, an organization like Bono does in Africa for debt relief. We need it in America. We have a website, stopthesqueeze.org, as a way to fight back, as a way for people who are in debt to stop being demonized by the media, which is what's happening now, and to be recognized as the victims they are.
Danny, we're going to lose our satellite in Durham, North Carolina, and I just wanted to ask our guest there, Keith Ernst, about the federal laws. For example, the possibility of an reintroduction of the Prohibit Predatory Lending Act that was introduced, I think, 2 years ago.
I think it's clear that legislation will be introduced in Congress, and we're hopeful that it'll move forward this time. You know, it's been talked about for years now, and we're hopeful that this year can be the year that legislation can move forward and help borrowers, because that, you know, as your guest there is saying, it's sorely needed now.
And Keith, could you talk, because one of the things, those of us who have a little bit of a historical memory on the housing crises in America, recall that we this country goes through periodic crises and speculation and abuse in housing, from the HUD crises of the 1960s, the savings and loans crisis of the 80s, and now we're confronted now in this decade with this huge crisis. And it seems like many of these characters just reappear with new companies and new banks or new lending procedures, but the same kind of scams. What can be done on a more consistent level, as Danny is raising, to be able to protect people who do not necessarily know all of their rights in terms of lending, especially when it comes to homes?
Right. Well, I think you're right that, you know, we've seen many episodes in you know, not too distant memory where mortgage lenders have essentially been betting people's houses, you know, so that they can make profits. And that's what ties all of these cycles together, is the mortgage lender says, hey, you know, take a loan from me. Don't worry about it. In 2 years, if you need to refinance, we'll be able to get you out of this loan. And, you know, eventually that house of cards comes crashing down. Now, moving forward, what can be done? I think, you know, the law should recognize the reality. Borrowers look to the person sitting opposite them at the table, most usually nowadays in the subprime market, a mortgage broker, as an expert, as someone who's helping them pick out their best mortgage. Sadly, this often could be, you know, could not be further from the truth. And so what the law should do is recognize what borrowers expect and need, which is that the person who's helping provide them a mortgage actually do just that, help provide them a mortgage that meets their needs.
Keith Ernst, we're gonna leave it there. I wanna thank you for being with us. We'll link to your website at the Center for Responsible Lending, speaking to us from Durham, North Carolina. Juan?
As we continue to look at the issue of subprime loans and debt, we turn to a new film by Danny Schechter called In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. This excerpt of the film looks at the prevalence of predatory lenders in the subprime industry.
The severity of the problem of home mortgage lending in a predatory way may be quantified in the following terms. You are talking in recent years of a problem that every year transfers hundreds of billions of dollars.
Hundreds of billions?
Hundreds of billions of dollars.
You said billions.
I said billions, not millions, from the pockets of the poor to people who are far better positioned than their so-called victims.
That's what happened to the Faez family. They trusted one of these scammers who demanded their house deed when they took out a loan. The family was soon dispossessed and out on the street. Their ordeal was so shocking that it made the newspapers.
When the marshal came, my children was having lunch on a Wednesday, the coldest day in January, and said, "You have 10 minutes to leave." My children had suffered nightmares. My son Daniel would hide under the seat of the car when he would see a police officer. You know, they still remember what they were having for lunch, what they had in the microwave that was left there. They could not even pack their things. Here I am, a hardworking mother of four at the time, not wanting to go on welfare. I'm sure they will pay a rent for us and give us food, but that's not our ambition. Wanting to keep our house as an inheritance for our children, it's not something wrong. And we weren't well educated as to how swift and conniving these people are.
That's what happened to Mary Pashkevitz. She teared up as she told me her story in front of the home she grew up in South Philadelphia. She lost it to a fraudulent home improvement scam.
It was very hard. I lost my father in this house. It upsets me. It upsets me immensely. I haven't been back around here for a while.
This is your place still in your heart.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. My father died in his house, and he never wanted me to lose it. And I feel like I failed him, too.
An excerpt of In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. The film is directed by Danny Schechter, the news dissector. A veteran journalist, Danny is also a media critic and co-founder of MediaChannel.org, one of the largest online media issues networks. He's has more than 20 films to his credit. Danny joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Danny, talk about these people and the broader context in which you did this film.
What I tried to do in the film is link the stories of the victims, of the people who are suffering, of whom there are now millions in America. This is a new Katrina, let's think of it that way, a disaster affecting low-income people, but also increasingly middle-income people as the income divide in America grows. The housing crunch is now spilling over into other parts of our lives. $25,000 on average is what students leave college with with loans and debts. People are paying, in the last year, some $65 billion just in late fees and interest payments on credit cards. This is a kind of a vacuum cleaner into your pocket and taking your money and swinging it over into the Wall Street so that Goldman Sachs can give out, you know, $16 billion Christmas gifts to its employees. It's blatant, it's obscene, and it's dramatic, and it's institutional, and this is what we have to realize. We talk about financialization, which is like the loan and credit complex, very much like the military-industrial complex that has emerged in this country, structured around big banks and credit card companies who are making large profits in the market and from us as consumers without very much scrutiny, in part because they spend $5 billion a year in marketing. You watch the Super Bowl, you see all the great spots for Visa and MasterCard. They're pervasive in the media, and the media is not doing a very good job of offering analysis. I mean, it's sort of stories Swan has been doing in the Daily News, who are really going into the neighborhoods, very few and far between in what we talk, what we see in our media about this problem. That's because America has shifted from a country that made things to a country that buys things. The factory used to be our icon of economic progress. Today it's the mall. And as a result, people are encouraged to shop till they drop. We'll lend you the money up front. And of course, the piper has to be paid at the end of the day. And that's why I made this film, because I began to realize like my savings was dribbling away. And lo and behold, America's savings rate is at below 5%. In other words, nobody has savings anymore. It's almost like the recession or depression levels. And there are a lot of very serious people who are warning of a repression, a recession rather. We have a repression, a recession, and worse as a result of these trends. That's why this issue has to be one to be organized around. It's a struggle to try to get a film out that challenges the really the center of power in America, financial power.
And then even on the issue of housing, the equity that people build up in their houses is constantly being attacked by people who want you to take out to take out loans based on the value of your house. But that assumes, obviously, that real estate values will continue to go up when they don't necessarily
well,
do.
Well, our homes have become ATM machines. You know, we're basically taking money out in equity until there is no more money to be taken out. And now it's impacting on, you know, high income people as well. The New York Times on Sunday said because of this whole crisis, the lenders are tightening up on criteria to buy, you know, $1 million condos and the rest, and housing is slowing in New York. A lot of people can't sell their homes the way they thought they would. You know, in New York and around the world, around America anyway, reality is spelt realty for most people. That's what they talk about, their apartments, how much they're worth, endlessly. Well, what happens when that value is gone, or when you don't have easy access to a market or people who want to buy your homes? You're in trouble.
I'd like to ask you for a second about the college loan situation. Recently in New York State, the new Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, went after some major universities. It turns out the universities were not only hooking up special deals with lenders, but were getting kickbacks by the volume of loans that they were able to direct their students to particular lenders.
Well, there's a lot of collusion here, you know, between the universities and the lenders, because there's a way to raise money for the university. When I was at the Rochester Institute of Technology, I went to a lecture by Dr. Robert Manning, who wrote a book, Credit Card Nation, detailing this problem. And just outside his lecture hall, I went to the bathroom, I went outside, and I said, oh my God, the banks have all set up tables, and they're signing kids up for credit cards and for accounts right here on the campus. And we went out, took our cameras out of the presentation, and we took it next door, and we saw this process at work. You know, all these kids want what everybody else has. They want to shop at the Gap. They want the nicest and the best and everything else, and they run up a tremendous credit card balances, and then they can't pay. And we have not only suicides being reported of young people in despair over all of this, but kids leave school. And what do? They have to find the first job they can to pay back. They can't come and volunteer at Democracy Now! Or MediaChannel.org because they have to pay off their loans. So their options, their life options, are being impacted by this as well. That's why this debt problem is not just an economic issue, not just affecting housing, but affecting our whole society. We, in our film, In Debt We Trust, we look at the bankruptcy bill that sailed through Congress with bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans supporting this measure. And this is why, after Katrina, we found out, guess what? The people in New Orleans couldn't file for bankruptcy when they lost their homes because floods had been taken out of the bill as a basis, for relief.
Danny, you also talk about scamming soldiers.
Yes, indeed. You know, 100,000 veterans coming back from the Iraq War are in debt, and they're dealing with these payday lenders. We were down in Norfolk, Virginia, around the naval base there. Last year, there had been 3 payday lenders. There are now 36 or 26 payday lenders and loan stores and what have you. People are going into hock, and they don't know how to get out of it. And we're talking about large numbers. And, you know, I was given access by the Naval and Marine Corps Relief Society, not people I usually hang with, you know, because they want to call attention to this problem. And it It affects everybody. That's why it's an issue that we should organize around. I reached out to MoveOn. I said, get involved on this issue because it's a way of bringing people together. We need common ground issues that can unite Americans for economic justice. And we're not seeing that happening. As factories close, as people lose their jobs, this credit crunch is really driving and taking away their assets. That's why In Debt We Trust is a very important film, I believe.
Well, Danny, you're using your film as an organizing tool. It's opening here in New York. Yeah, where
here it
tonight?
Is, Amy. This is the actual DVD, which is out. We have a website, indebtwetrust.com, and stopthesqueeze.org. We're trying to run a campaign alongside the film to get people active, a little bit the way Robert Greenwald did with his Outfoxed movie, but we're trying to take it one step further and actually organize people and encourage them to organize. We have all the major groups like the National Center for Responsible Lending and ACORN are in the film and other organizations, NEPAD here in New York.
And it's opening tonight,
at the Quad Cinema.
In New York City.
13th Street, 7:50, tomorrow night, 7:50 p.m. at the Quad. Please come. Please tell your friends.
Well, Denny, we want to ask you to stay with us as we're going to move to another issue after break. We're going to be speaking with the freed journalist Josh Wolf. He'll join us from San Francisco. Danny Schechter, the news dissector. His film is called In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. Stay with us.
He used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed the mark. When there was wheat to plow, all guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run.
Dr. John singing Yip Harburg's song, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, and our headlines are also available in Spanish and headline, in transcript, and in audio form for any radio station to take. Over 140 stations are taking them around the world. Juan?
Well, after a record 7.5 months behind bars, San Francisco video blogger Josh Wolf has been released. Wolf walked out of a federal prison in Dublin, California, Tuesday after prosecutors dropped a key demand that had made him the longest jailed journalist for protecting a source in U.S. history. Wolf was jailed on August 1st of last year when he refused to turn over video that he had shot of an anti-G8 demonstration in San Francisco.
Josh Wolf's release was okayed after prosecutors agreed to drop their effort to make him testify before a grand jury and identify protesters shown on his video. In return, Josh posted the uncut video on his website, gave prosecutors a copy, and testified he knew nothing about violent incidents at the protest. In a national broadcast exclusive, Josh Wolf joins us now from studio in San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Josh.
Thanks, Amy. Good morning.
How does it feel to be free?
It feels great and a bit overwhelming. It's been sort of nonstop stimulus after spending over 6 months in a world where everything is the same day in and day out, and there's no real stimulus to speak of. So it's a bit overwhelming, like coming to Manhattan for the first time or something like that.
Explain the deal you made with prosecutors.
Well, basically, we came to an agreement that had been on the table since November, which is that While my unpublished video material should be protected, once I had been unsuccessful in all the appeals for the legal battle, there was no real point in maintaining control of material that had no news value, no evidentiary value, and was basically just my outtakes for editing purposes. There was nothing edited for content. It was all done for pacing and that sort of thing. So there was no real reason not to publish it other than the fact that the government had subpoenaed it. So once we had lost those appeals, we inquired with the U.S. Attorney as to whether or not there'd be some possible thing where we could give up the footage and I could walk out. And the U.S. Attorney was like, no, we need the full cooperation of the subpoena, all demands. And so I sat here until the judge ordered into mediation, actually, I believe the day after I last appeared on your show.
And then in terms of the actual agreement, what happened to the video then?
The video was first published on my website, and then sometime after that, we filed a motion for my release along with the declaration, and the declaration contained a DVD with the same material that was posted on the website.
Now, just to explain, Josh, I believe when we first talked, you said that you were not, you know, gathering this videotape for the state. You were not going to hand it over to them, although you were sorry ultimately. You said that you hadn't just published the whole thing on your website to begin with. So why did you change your mind?
I think I was pretty, I tried to be very careful in my interviews and said I will not submit to the demands of the subpoena. I will not testify. I may have inadvertently said I will not turn it over, and I had wanted to just simply publish it and tell them to download it. But for some reason in the law, you can't just file an affidavit that says you can download the video at this website. And so that was a compromise I didn't particularly want to make, in that I was physically turning it over. But that's a principal issue, and in reality, if they get it on a disc or they get it on a website, it really is only principle that are at stake there.
And you agreed, the prosecutors agreed, not only you wouldn't have to testify, you wouldn't have to identify people on this videotape.
Well, the prosecutor simply agreed that I could submit a declaration providing the answers to two of their concerns, which they laid before me prior to me making any statements about those concerns.
And what were those two questions?
They're covered in the declaration itself. One is, can I identify the person who Officer Shields was chasing, which I have no idea who that was. And the second question was, did I witness the incident of the alleged attempted arson on the police car, the, quote, throwing the firecracker or something of that nature?
And what did you respond to that?
That, again, I was filming his Officer Shields' partner during the time that allegedly occurred, so it would have been impossible for me to see that happen, and my unpublished material demonstrates that.
In terms of the time you spent in jail, was there any your thoughts about how long that they might keep you? Did you get a sense that they were going to try to hold you indefinitely?
I can't say I think they were going to hold me indefinitely. It would have taken some legalistic gymnastics to pull that off, but it did seem quite evident that I was going to be there until January, after the grand jury had been extended twice. The reason that those concerns became apparent was the fact that the Balco investigation, the Greg Anderson steroid scandal, is, we believe, in the same grand jury, and that's been cited as one of the most pressing cases in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So if this case is so important to them, more than likely, I'm going to be stuck inside of that and not released till January, which would mean that unless a Grumbles motion were to be successful, and several people had indicated that it was highly unlikely that the Northern District was going to grant any Grumbles motions on the grounds that it sets, you know, bad politics or that sort of thing.
Danny Schechter.
I'm worried about this on a bunch of levels. The use of grand juries against journalist is one of those concerns. MediaChannel.org has raised this issue, has supported you. Josh, we welcome you back. We're glad you're out. But, you know, beyond this, there's the sort of persecution of journalists by a very compromised U.S. Attorney's Office. We don't know all the political factors behind the persecution of Josh Wolf here. This may be tied to this larger scandal, may not, of the U.S. Attorney General's. I'd like to know that. But also the fact that he's a freelancer. You know, we have our media system is changing. There's so many more people who are video, you have video cameras who are out there and who are not, quote, journalists in the normal traditional sense, but nevertheless do journalistic work. And they deserve protection under the First Amendment, but also support by media freedom groups. I was glad to see that the Committee to Protect Journalists finally got in on this case and began to demand his release. We need
the Society of Professional Journalists named Josh Journalist of the Year, California chapter.
Gradually, people did rally behind Josh. I'm glad that they did. We certainly did. But we need more vigilance on these issues because this tactic is likely to be used again by people, federal prosecutors on fishing expeditions looking for information and knowing that journalists won't cooperate. They are quite happy to try to keep them in prison and prosecute them and send a signal and the like. And we have to send a signal back that this is unacceptable.
Josh, what are your plans now?
Well, the next day or two, I'll probably spend a lot of time doing interviews such as this one. I've got a couple projects that I'm trying to engage in. One is very focused on the issues that Danny Schachter just brought up, which is called Free the Media. I basically wanted to take the momentum that's been gathered around my situation and develop a sort of interactive, a Web 2.0 environment, if you will, for people to discuss and come to light with new issues, raise campaigns around any other people that should find themselves in the same situation. So that's called Free the Media and is at mediafreedoms.net.
And just to explain, you were protected by the California Journalist Shield Law, but we don't have a federal Journalist Shield Law. And because, at least the argument the U.S. attorney used, because there was some money that went into the buying of the police car that they say there was an alleged arson against, then that put you in a different category?
Right. It's not exactly that it put me in a different category. That's what allowed the federal government to get involved, because the 14th Amendment says that there's certain things that are the state's matter of order, and there's certain things that are within federal limits. And this shouldn't have been able to even be accessible by the federal government. They basically used this whole, well, there's some money in the police department as a crux to get their hands into the situation and to circumvent the California State Shield Law. So That further shows why we need a federal shield law. If it's protected in 49 states and the federal government can just make an inroad around the federal shield law, then this can affect independent journalists like myself, but also mainstream media just as equally. In fact, the argument that I wasn't a journalist, which the U.S. attorney tried to put forward, didn't even come about until after I had been incarcerated.
Last 20 seconds, Josh, your thoughts to share with people in this country and around the world about your prison experience and now what your plans are.
It's been quite a dramatic series of events, a long saga, which I'm finally glad has come to its conclusion. I think it demonstrates to the public that their media is really under attack. A free press is not something that the government is very fond of, and they're going to do everything to try to stop that. And it's time for us to realize how important it is for the free flow of information, because news is what people don't want you to know. Everything else is PR, and we're moving more and more towards a PR-based press, and that's a very scary thought.
Josh Wolf, independent video blogger, recently released from jail. He was the longest imprisoned journalist in this country for refusing to testify before a grand jury, speaking to us in San Francisco. And we will link to his website as we wrap up today on this very important anniversary. Juan?
Well, 40 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King gave the speech Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. It was April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he was murdered. He was speaking at the Riverside Church here in New York. King billed the speech as a declaration of independence from the war and called the United States, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Time magazine called his speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. And the Washington Post declared that King had, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people. We turn now to that speech that King gave in April 1967.
If we do not stop our war against the people of Vietnam immediately, the world will be left with no other alternative than to see this as some horrible, clumsy, and deadly game we have decided to play. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. It demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam, that we have been detrimental to the life of the Vietnamese people. The situation is one in which we must be ready to turn sharply from our present ways. In order to atone for our sins and errors in Vietnam, we should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war and set a date that we will remove all foreign troops from Vietnam in accordance with the 1954 Geneva Agreement, part of our ongoing... Part of our ongoing commitment might well express itself in an offer to grant asylum to any Vietnamese who fears for his life under the new regime, which included the Liberation Front. Then we must make what reparations we can for the damage we have done. We must provide the medical aid that is badly needed, making it available in this country if necessary. Meanwhile... Meanwhile, we in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices and our lives if our nation persists in its perverse ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest. Now, that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. giving his Beyond Vietnam speech at Riverside Church. It was April 4th, 1967, 40 years ago today. A year later, he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aramate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks also to Angela Alston, Andrew Quinn. Also on April 16th, Patriots Day, I will be with Howard Zinn in Boston. Go to our website to find out details at Faneuil Hall. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.